One of the great barriers to simcha, to joy, is being confined in a world that I think I know. Because if I see the world as locked in, as a mechanistic process, which is simply playing itself out, then I'm going to lose all sense of agency, any sense that what I do really matters. And therefore, I'm going to lose hope. And you know, hope is the wellspring which flows into joy. You know, it's interesting in this light to note the fact that prayer really is an expression of hope. I mean, when you look around and you see a situation that it seems you can't affect, reaching out to the creator of the universe and pouring out your heart and the desire of what you'd like to see be is the ultimate act of agency. This is why when the prophet Isaiah came to King Hezekiah and he said to him, "Listen, God said you're going to die. Time to pack your bags." Hezekiah said, "No, wait. I'm going to pray." I mean, Isaiah is a prophet. He said, "I just told you God said, why are you going to pray?" And Hezekiah replied to him that I have a tradition, Mibet Avi, right, from my father's father's house, meaning from King David, that even if the sword is resting at your neck, don't give up to pray. Now, by the way, I would say that it's true that a mechanistic view of the universe removes all hope and therefore joy, even if my estimation is that the world is moving inevitably toward a good place. I mean, it's true, I may not lose hope, but if the process doesn't require my active participation to make it happen, then the result is going to be lethargy and fatalism. An unengaged life itself lacks joy, even if the future holds some promise of happiness. This is how I understand the Gemara statement that three things come behesech dat, right? When my mind is simply elsewhere. The scorpion's bite, a lost object, and the Messiah. First is obvious, and those of you in the land of Israel should be careful sticking your hands in places without paying attention. The second is about finding something once you've stopped looking. Why does that happen? I think it so often happens because of our habits of vision. We have patterns of where we look and how we see. And when something is lost, it's by definition not where we expect to find it. So sometimes it takes that act of giving up, of saying, I simply can't see, the admission that there are limits to my vision, which actually opens up to us a new horizon. This in turn illuminates the third example, Mashiach. Right? You know, the Messiah is not going to be found by looking in the same old places. If the Messiah were already here, and we simply weren't listening, I think the world would be a pretty sad place. Mashiach is a revolutionary watershed of consciousness, which is going to teach us that the world is not bounded by our judgments. Humanity is capable of more, and the past does not dictate the future. There have been many critical moments in our history that can teach us this lesson of how to see redemption by looking beyond what we know. But I'd like to start with the Red Sea. I mean, listen, here we are, trapped between the Egyptians behind and the sea in front. What could be more reasonable than the desire of the Israelites to give up on redemption when caught between the enemy and the sea? There's no way out. When Nachshon ben Aminadab wades into the water up to his nostrils, pushing right up to the boundaries of what he knew, and you know what happened? They retreated. The sea split, and the process of redemption rolled forward. Not because it was inevitable, but because one person refused to accept the so-called reality of the situation. And by the way, it's worth noting that the instinctive response to such a revelation, to the exposure of the tenuous hold our perception actually has on reality, is song. Rashi says that when the sea split, the song of the sea, Allah b'libo shel Moshe, it just came up into his heart. He didn't have to think about it. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't even a logical response. It was the natural thing to do. And I think that's because of what the Gemara in Erchin says, that Ezo hu avodah shehi b'simcha u'b'tuv lev. What is divine service, which is really in joy and a happiness of heart? Havi omer, zo shira. I would say that this is song. And as Rav Cook taught us in the last podcast, the joy of divine service is in attaching myself to something which is larger than I. In touching beyond the boundaries of my consciousness. And the Gemara is telling us that the expression of that experience is found in song. You know, the gift of the unbounded element within life can bring the joy of freedom, like at the Red Sea, or the fear. Because just after we crossed the Red Sea, we met our nemesis, Amalek. Now, what exactly did Amalek do in that moment to merit the undying enmity of God? And indeed, to be labeled as the shadow side of Am Yisrael's divine mission to bring wholeness to creation down through time? Well, the Torah says, Asher karcha baderech, right? And there are two explanations of this phrase, and I think they open a critical window on how we can access the gift of joy by breaking through the boundaries of the known. Asher karcha baderech, they sought to cool us down, says Rashi, right? They wanted to reduce the cosmic significance of the exodus from Egypt to a political event. They wanted to remove our excitement through showing us that, you know, the revelation and redemption are not going to be a smooth process. You're not going to simply smash Egypt, go through the Red Sea, and head on straight to Sinai, right? If there are still challenges ahead on the road, then have I truly been redeemed? Or am I just kidding myself? You know, Asher karcha baderech, right? They also happened upon us by the way, right? They wanted to reduce redemption to a coincidence. Mikre keri, just happened. Sure, the splitting of the Red Sea was amazing, right? But who knows? Maybe it was an earthquake. There was a super tide, pulled back the water. The moon was just rightly aligned as Nachshon stepped in. You know what? These things you talk about in significance may not have really happened. Or, says Amalek, even if they really happen, they're not going to liberate us from the confines of the reality as we know it. You know, on the contrary, they're going to cast doubt on our ability to even draw right conclusions from our own experience. Rather than freeing reality, these cataclysmic events can just cast doubt on what we know. And here is the core of the issue. My need to believe I know might give me a sense of comfort and the illusion of control, but it sets me up for sadness and a crisis of faith. That sadness is rooted in a life which is bounded by what I already know, in which, as I said before, the past dictates the present and therefore the future, right? It's a mechanistic world lacking joy. The crisis of Emunah is in the need to then shrink God to the dimensions of man. Because if God is bigger than I can know, then my sense of comfort and control are going to be replaced by fear. And this is the tool of Amalek. They offer a choice between shrinking the world and God to fit my limited conceptions, which we call idolatry, or living in fear, which is intolerable. And you know what? That false dichotomy, the need to choose between two miserable options, breaking it is the gift that Purim offers us. The tikkun of Amalek, the fixing of faith. Think back to Nachshon at the Red Sea. He could have judged that situation impossible and decided the only option was to go back to Egypt. Or he could have given up hope and just laid down to die. But instead he thought to himself, I wonder what God has in store here. And that wonder, the openness to the possibility of a world which was not defined by his perception and his evaluation of the situation, is exactly what allowed him to move forward into the sea. And of course, it split. And his wonder and his fearless engagement of what is, without any expectation of what would be, allowed the joy and song to rush in. So wonder, the transformation of the fearful, doubt-filled attitude of, I don't know, to the wonder-filled, I don't know, is the transformation of Amalek into Emunah. And this is why the Maharal taught us that the emotive state of Emunah is Simcha, right? When I am attached to the reality of God, my heart is filled with joy. It's the joy of knowing that the world is wide open with possibility, responsive to my actions, but not confined to my conceptions. It's the simcha of a people whose socio-political analysis was, it's all over. You know, Haman's in charge. The Jews are divided and powerless. There is no hope. And then, in a moment, Nahafohu, everything was overturned. And we went from being the pursued to being the pursuers. And in the next podcast, we're going to look at the turning point of this process a little more closely. But just for now, you can take a peek in the book of Esther, the fourth chapter, and the 14th line, when Mordechai has his critical and indeed truly only spoken line of the whole Megillah. And he says to Esther, listen, we need your help. And mi yodea, who knows if you haven't arrived to where you are for just this reason. And in raising this issue as a possibility, rather than declaring the reality, I mean, he could have said, it's clear to me that God put you there only for the reason to save us. But then, of course, it's a mechanistic world. So instead, he invites Esther to be Nachshon in that moment, and therefore opens the possibility for redemption, which is not bounded by his imagination. Mi yodea. Who knows what could be? So, my advice to you is, next time you're feeling down, trapped by the weight of what is, by the analysis of what could possibly be, and lacking joy, just ask yourself, who knows what could be? And instead of saying, who knows where salvation will come from, tell yourself, who knows where salvation will come from? And then move forward to make it happen. If you like this podcast, you can find more on SulamYaakov.com. You can find the sounds of Sulam Yaakov on iTunes and Stitcher. You can find us on SoundCloud, or you can come on down to Nachlaot and sit in the Beit Midrash.